A genetic disorder snakes through Bonnie Ruff's family tree. Hypohidrotic ectodermal dysplasia, or HED, is carried by mothers and passed on to sons. Sufferers of the disorder cannot sweat, have trouble breathing, sleeping, staying awake, and often appear ill. Many are. Immunodeficiency associated with the condition may lead to a lifetime of infections. Until the human genome was mapped, the women and men in Ruff's family only knew that something was wrong, not what caused it. Bonnie Ruff researched the disorder and discovered she was a carrier. In her new book, Carrier, Untangling the Danger in My DNA, Ruff tells the story of her own tough decisions and how the effects of HED ripped through her family. Bonnie Ruff is in the studio of member station KUOW in Seattle, Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Leanne.
Bonnie, how did you discover that HED ran in your family?
Actually, I had always known from my mother's stories when we were growing up that her father had struggled with a disorder that turned his life in many ways into a tragedy. My grandfather, Earl, died penniless, alone, and addicted to drugs at the age of 49 when I was just a baby.
How is it he came to die so early?
By that time in his life, his body was ruined by drugs, but also by infections and by organ failure and also by pain and depression.
You were the first generation to actually be tested. Was there any way you could have avoided the condition? In other words, it's 25% if you're pregnant that you'll pass it on, but what were the chances that you would actually have it?
Knowing that my mother is a carrier of the disorder, half of her daughters, statistically speaking, you know, in theory, would be born as carriers. So this is written in my DNA along with those stories from my family history, which I chased down in order to try to give myself some historical context for what choices to make for the future of my family. Many families have the same tricky choices. You could just choose to go on and see what fate hands to you and accept that. You could decide no risk is worth it. We're not going to have children, or we may adopt. Dan and I, through the course of this story, thought that well, we considered all of those options, but in the end decided that we did want to have biological children, and we did want them to be healthy. So that meant that our options really were two. We could spend tens of thousands of dollars for in vitro fertilization and pre-implantation genetic diagnosis of embryos. In other words, doctors would choose embryos that had no sign of the disorder to implant in hopes of creating a successful pregnancy. Mm-hmm. The other choice would have been to start a pregnancy in the usual way and then test the fetus through a process called chorionic villus sampling, or later with an amniocentesis, in order to find out whether the baby had inherited the disorder and then potentially face an excruciating decision.
Mm. I'm speaking with Bonnie Ruff. She's the author of the book Carrier, Untangling the Danger of My DNA. Your first pregnancy, you knew you were having a girl?
Well, we didn't know we were having a girl right away. I had experienced with my first pregnancy a tentative pregnancy, and knowing that we would get DNA results back about the baby's health at around 13 weeks of pregnancy. The news that we were having a daughter was truly a day for celebration. I did have a brief second pregnancy where we did the same kind of testing and unfortunately got the news that our baby would be affected with the disorder that runs in my family. So we did ultimately face the very difficult choice that I spent years preparing myself for and laying out a plan.
Mm. You had a procedure. The pregnancy was terminated. How do you describe your own emotions at that time?
My emotions at that time were a surprise to me, actually. I had spent probably 3 years researching my family history, asking myself what had happened to the people in the past and how that could possibly relate to my potential children in the future, and how to use those stories as a touchstone for making these big choices. And I was unsure all the time whether the way I was using those stories in my heart, and whether the plans that my husband and I were laying with love and mercy in mind would feel right if we ever really were faced with that crisis moment. And I was so relieved that they did. It was not easy, but I did not feel that I wanted to go back or change my mind. The other surprise for me, the real surprise for me, was in that moment when my genetic counselor called with the devastating news that our baby wasn't going to be healthy. I was crying in my husband's arms and feeling at the same time this swelling of gratitude, which stunned me. How could I feel thankful in this moment? But I really did. I felt so grateful that I could know and that I could choose.
Bonnie Ruff is the author of Carrier, Untangling the Danger in My DNA. She spoke to us from the studio of member station KUOW in Seattle, Washington. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Leanne.
Tomorrow night, HBO will broadcast a new half-hour documentary about the transformative effects of low-cost antiretroviral drugs in the fight against AIDS in Africa. 8 years ago, such medication would have cost $10,000 per person per year. Since then, global health groups and private organizations have worked to reduce that number. The drugs now cost less than a bag of potato chips, around 40 cents a day. The Lazarus Effect focuses on the experiences of four people in Zambia whose lives have been touched by AIDS. The documentary's director, Lance Bangs, is in the studio of member station WFPL in Louisville, Kentucky. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
You follow four people in the film, beginning with a woman named Connie Mudenda, and she's an HIV clinic supervisor in Lusaka, Zambia. But she has a story of her own.
She's one of the people we were speaking to in context of, like, you know, if you see someone who comes in that you think would be a good candidate for us, please give us a call or let us know. Can we come see how your clinic works? And then she sort of mentioned, like, oh, in my own experience, you know, how I ended up doing this is that I had lost three children of my own to AIDS in the time before this treatment was available in Africa. And then as she was walking in a market one day, she heard a woman kind of yelling, like, you know, Boilani, Boilani, come around here, sort of announcing that the treatment had become available. So at that point, she went and got tested, realized that she was HIV positive and qualified, and began treatment. That would have been 2004 that she began. So here we are 6 years later, and I wouldn't have known or guessed by looking at her that she was HIV positive. She was just this incredibly powerful, forceful, confident, striking, dynamic woman that was not only supervising one clinic, but during the time we were with her, overseeing three different clinics and just putting all of her energy and aggression and frustration and into working and doing this radical work, supervising a number of clinics.
There's a little girl that you feature. Her name is Bwalya.
Correct.
Tell us her story. I mean, the first picture we see of her, she looks like it's almost skeletal, like a five-year-old, and she was much older.
We were at one clinic spending the day visiting people, and this young girl came in who I thought looked like a very ill, you know, five-year-old maybe. And we sort of spoke to her and her aunt who had brought her in and realized that she's actually 11 years old and that she just had, you know, sort of failed to develop and had been in such a weakened state from the lack of white blood cells and, you know, weakened immune system, and it had stunted her development and growth.
Yeah, and she did get better, and she says the one thing that she loves now is going to school.
Yeah, that was, you know, in the first interview, I felt sad because she was, you know, describing, like, oh, I miss being able to play with friends. I stay indoors all the time. I wish I could go to school. And I just thought, like, ah, you know, there's just no way. But sure enough, we went back in August and September after originally meeting her in May of last year. And it was stunning. She just, you know, came out of a doorway, and it was the same door we had filmed her in when she took her first dosage of the medication. And now she comes out, and, you know, we almost couldn't film it because we all just broke down. Like, the translator kind of runs into the shot and gives her a hug and is like, ah, like, I can't believe how much you've grown. And, you know, we just all sort of fell apart with joy and ecstasy at seeing her emerge from that doorway. She really did look like an 11-year-old girl all of a sudden. She was taller and thinner and more muscle tone and happy. And, you know, all that emerges when you really get to see someone in their healthier state.
Yeah. In your film, you note that about 3,800 Africans die every day from AIDS. And to stay healthy, people who are taking these free or subsidized antiretrovirals they're going to have to take them every day for the rest of their lives. Who's paying for this? Who's looking after long-term care?
Yeah, at the moment, the funding that was making the biggest difference to the people we saw and visited comes from the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Malaria, and Tuberculosis. So they get the money from some governments, and there are other, you know, countries that are donating to it on a large scale as well. And then separately, their charter was set up that they have to get corporate donations to kind of like match or to offset that. So it's not just governments pouring money into it.
So how are the people that you filmed? You saw them
remarkably well. Yeah. Like we met one of the women, Concilia, and then Connie, who, you know, supervises the clinic. They were both actually able to come over to New York earlier this month when we did a premiere. Connie still oversees clinics. She went and saw Oprah Winfrey speak at Radio City Music Hall, and her, you know, seeing Oprah on stage, she got even more like, yeah, like, you know, I shouldn't let anything hold me back. I can do whatever. And so she's back in Zambia and even more empowered and renewed. And the girl, Bwalya, I think she finished at the top of her class, and she did come down with tuberculosis recently, so she was kind of fighting that off. But because she's going to this clinic, you know, to get checkups on the AIDS issues, they're also spotting that in a way that maybe she wouldn't have been spotted if she'd just been off, you know, alone in her home without the kind of contact that you get regularly going to this clinic now.
Lance Bangs is the director of The Lazarus Effect. The half-hour documentary debuts tomorrow night on HBO. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Welcome back to All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Now, just about any amateur astronomer can tell you the basics about Jupiter. It's the fifth planet from the sun. It's got a giant red spot on its lower half, and wrapped around it are two thick brown stripes, each one about as wide as planet Earth. Well, check your telescope tonight, and you'll find one of those stripes, the southern one, has gone missing, and scientists aren't entirely sure why. Kelly Beatty is a senior contributing editor for Sky and Telescope magazine, and he joins me now from member station WBUR in Boston to tell us a bit more about what's going on. Kelly Beatty, welcome.
Thank you, Guy.
So when did you first notice this stripe or band in the southern half of Jupiter was gone?
Amateur astronomers around the world started noticing this actually last fall. And then Jupiter ducked behind the sun for a few months, and only about April did it come back into the morning sky where it could be viewed again. And when astronomers looked again, this belt, this dark band, had completely disappeared.
So when they first saw it, it wasn't completely gone. It was sort of fading?
Right. It tends to fade out. This is not the first time this has happened. It happens every 10 years or so. It's 18 times since the turn of the 19th century. So we know that it does happen, and we have some confidence that the belt will come back, but we just don't know why.
Can you sort of describe what these bands are made up of?
Sure. Jupiter is a very big place. It's about 11 times the diameter of the Earth. And unlike the Earth, it doesn't have a solid surface. What we see when we look through a telescope is a planet-wide cloud deck surrounding the entire place. So these two bands, which are kind of like racing stripes around the midsection of Jupiter, are dark bands that have a different composition than the other clouds around them. What scientists think has happened is that some kind of disturbance has taken over in the southern hemisphere and kind of created cirrus clouds, maybe, that has completely enveloped the planet and covered this band with a high, thin blanket that will eventually go away.
So all that's really happened, they think, is that it's there, but it's just being obscured?
That's right. That's the theory, anyway.
So when is it expected to return?
Well, I can tell you, Guy, that there are amateur astronomers around the world with their eyes glued to their telescopes in the hope that they will be the first to be able to see the beginning of the return of this South Equatorial Belt.
But nobody knows. Nobody knows.
No one knows. It could be 6 months from now. It could be 2 years from now.
Now, obviously, Jupiter is a popular planet for amateur stargazers. When is a good time to see Jupiter if you have a telescope?
First of all, if you're just eyeballing the sky, Jupiter is easy to spot in the morning sky before dawn. It's a bright star in the eastern sky. It's the only star that bright anywhere nearby. It's very obvious. And if you have a pair of binoculars, you can look at it. You'll see, hold them steady, and you'll see that Jupiter is actually a little disk. If you have a small telescope, you'll be able to see not only this disk, but the two stripes across it, or what were the two stripes, and you'll only see one. And that will be an indication that something is very wrong.
Now, we probably wouldn't have found out about this as quickly had it not been for amateur astronomers, right?
You raise a good point. In astronomy, amateur sky watchers and professionals have a very close relationship. There aren't enough professionals to keep track of everything going on in the universe all the time. So in a sense, they rely on amateur astronomers, who have very good equipment, by the way, to actually keep an eye on things, look for supernovas or watch for stars that pulsate, and in this case, watch for changes on the planets in our solar system. And when they see something, they notify the professionals and the big guns get swung over to take a better look.
Kelly Beattie, one last question for you. When you look at a photograph of Jupiter, it is actually quite a beautiful planet, probably second only in beauty to Saturn, I would say, right?
Yes.
Do you kind of miss it? I mean, do you kind of miss that second stripe?
I do. I kind of miss the symmetry of it because it tells me that there is order on Jupiter. And right now, the fact that one belt is missing, it's like a missing tooth. There is disorder on Jupiter, and we just don't know why.
That's Kelly Beattie. He's a senior contributing editor for Sky and Telescope magazine. He joined me from WBUR in Boston. Kelly, thank you so much.
Oh, a pleasure, Guy. Thanks.
We asked to speak with a Facebook representative. The company declined, but sent a statement that said, in the coming weeks, Facebook plans to address some of the concerns raised by privacy advocates. Meantime, they referred us to the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation. Daniel Castro is a senior analyst there, and he joins me from Atlanta. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Do you believe that because Facebook is a free service, that the company has the right to use information about its users as it wishes?
No, I don't think they have the right to use the information as they want. I do think that they have a responsibility to disclose to users how they're going to use that information. And I think they've done a decent job of doing that, although there's been a lot of confusion lately because of the changes they've implemented.
I mean, you say confusion, but when a lot of people signed up to Facebook, you know, they didn't necessarily know that all of those things they filled out, gender and marital status and age and the jobs they have, they didn't know that all of that would one day be used to build profiles for advertisers.
With Facebook, they're not actually selling users' information, which is, I think, the number one misconception out there. They're not giving away any kind of information to advertisers. What they're doing is they're selling targeted advertising based on the information they have about you.
Right. I mean, they're sort of building kind of categories of people.
Right. Well, they're building demographic profiles about people, the same as any program you watch on TV has a demographic profile about who watches the television show. The difference is on the internet, you can be more targeted.
I mean, you say that they're not passing along our personal data, our individual profile data, to advertisers. But as you know, and as we just heard on this program, they were doing this as late as last week, whether it was inadvertent or not. So why is it enough for us to just trust that Facebook will never pass along or sell our individual data when, you know, we all know it has the power to do that?
Well, I think there's a couple of interesting things here with the Wall Street Journal article that we heard about. For one, what Facebook was doing there and what other companies were doing in this instance was something that wasn't specific to advertisers. On the internet in general, when you click a link, it shows the website to which you go to where you came from. So in this case, because you came from a Facebook page, in some instances, your user ID, which is something Facebook considers public, would be passed on to any website that you clicked a link to go to that website.
But then that advertiser can use your user ID to find out what public information you have out there, and a lot of people don't really know that they don't have that hidden.
Well, there's two things. First of all, they can only find out public information about you. Second of all, no advertiser has said they've done this. And third, this would actually go against Facebook's terms of service for its advertisers. So if any advertiser did this, they would actually be breaking the terms of service with Facebook.
But we know that Facebook can do that. I mean, they're saying this was a software bug, but we know that they can do that. Is it enough for us, the users, to just trust Facebook, or should there be some kind of regulation?
Well, you actually have a choice right now. You have the option of not using them and going to another software company who is going to make that promise to you. But I think in general, we don't need government regulation in this space because government regulation would actually impose speed bumps on innovation, and that's what we don't want. I think what we've seen is there's a very narrow group of people, privacy fundamentalists, that value privacy over all other values. And what they want to do is set a single standard for all users that's imposed by government. I don't think it's right for a number of reasons. But in particular, people have very different value systems. Some people want to share as much information as possible because they get a better experience on the internet. And I think we should allow companies to do that.
That's Daniel Castro. He's a senior analyst with the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation. He joined us from WABE in Atlanta. Daniel Castro, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. The troubles in Greece have dominated financial news lately, but the future of the European economy probably depends more on what happens in Spain. Its economy is four times larger than that of Greece. Through much of the last decade, Spain was booming. For a while, two out of every five new jobs in Europe were created there. No more. The unemployment rate now is above 20%, and a quick recovery seems unlikely. NPR's Tom Gelton has more on Spain's rise and fall.
In March 2004, Spain was a Time magazine cover story. The headline, Spain Rocks. The economy was on a roll. Consumers were on a spending binge, and so was the government. The metro in Madrid had just been expanded. 25 miles of new train tunnels, 28 new metro stations. Madrid during those years became a better place to live and work. There was huge demand for new homes. Spain was number one in housing starts across Europe. Mortgages were cheap, banks eager to lend. In fact, all this construction activity was itself driving Spain's economic growth, and that was where Spain's problems started. There was too much construction. Fernando Vallebriga directs the economics department at the ASADE Business School in Madrid.
I mean, it's unsustainable. The construction sector got to something like 20% of GDP at some years, which is, yeah, it makes no sense.
Construction more typically accounts for about 5% of a country's economy. When it's 20% of GDP, trouble follows. Here's why. If you make cars or grow olives, you can sell them at home or abroad. But once a new building goes up, it stays right there, whether you need it or not. And in Spain, the construction boom petered out about 3 years ago. Three big cranes stand idle at this building site on the far north side of Madrid. Four apartment buildings were going up here, but then the construction stopped for lack of demand. A scene reminiscent of suburbs in Florida or outside Las Vegas. Alejandro Martinez and Paula Rosa, walking with their groceries past this empty building site, say they're stuck with the apartment they bought here 5 years ago. The market has collapsed, Alejandro says. I ask what percentage of the apartments in this neighborhood are occupied. No more than 60%, he says. Less, says Paula. There are many empty houses here, she says. A ton. With the sudden drop in construction here, jobs disappeared. This shows another problem with a growth model built on construction. Employment swings up and down dramatically.
The Spanish economy is labor-intensive.
Joaquin Arango of the Ortega y Gasset Foundation points out that the economic boom in Spain brought more people into the workforce, but mostly in low-skill areas like construction. A lot of the jobs could be filled by foreign-born workers. Arango, a sociologist, has documented the surge in the immigrant population that began with the economic boom in the late 1990s.
As a percentage of the population at the beginning of that period was 2.5% or so, and now it is over 12%.
That's dramatic.
Yeah, spectacular.
The number of immigrants arriving here during those years, about 5 million, was second only to the United States. But there's a flip side. Many have now lost their jobs. One out of three foreign-born workers in Spain is now unemployed. And then there's the youth population. For them, it's even worse. About 75,000 students are enrolled this spring at the sprawling Complutense University of Madrid. Given the dismal job market, there's not much else for young people to do. Ana Arbulo and Gerardo Collazo, relaxing between classes, say they have to lower their sights.
Las perspectivas que tenemos es trabajar en el Burger King.
Our hope is to work at Burger King, says Ana.
Pasarnos unos cuantos años estudiando hasta que se arregle la situación.
Or just stay in school, says Gerardo, until the situation gets better.
Si acabásemos ahora, estaríamos ya empezando en el paro.
Their classmate, Alma Ortiz, notes that since they've just begun college, they won't have to deal with the job world for another 3 or 4 years. What's missing in their outlook is any sense of promise, opportunity, and excitement about their futures.
Porque hay mucha gente desesperada por encontrar trabajo. Y al haber tanta gente, pues...
There's so many people desperate to find work out there, Gerardo says. So employers can demand experience. For a young person, he says, competing with older people who are themselves desperate, it's just so much more difficult. His friends nod in agreement. I ask Alma Ortiz what advice her parents give her.
Yo que estudie y que tenga los máximos estudios posibles, o en el caso más grave que haga unas oposiciones a funcionaria.
To study hard, she says, or get a government job. This tendency to look to the government for employment, not the private sector, goes to the heart of what's plaguing Spain right now. The economy here has lost much of its creativity. Fernando Bayabriga of the Asada Business School says Spain needs to develop its entrepreneurial potential, beginning with the young people now emerging from colleges and universities.
We have the generation with the highest education level ever, and we are not providing the opportunities for this generation to contribute to the development of new, more high-tech, value-added sectors.
Bayabriga and other critics of Spanish government policy say the country could have a more competitive economy if it were easier for Spanish employers to get rid of unproductive workers during a downturn and hire better-educated, more forward-looking workers when they're ready to expand. That would require a reform of what are now relatively rigid labor market policies. But without it, Bayabriga says, the unemployment burden falls disproportionately on young people. Nearly 40% of Spaniards under the age of 26 today, he points out, are without work. Of every 5 young people here, 2 are unemployed.
To a large extent, these people is suffering the consequences of the adjustment, whereas less productive workers are still in place.
Much attention has been paid on the need for Spain to trim its budget deficit, ditto for Greece and Portugal and other indebted European countries. But the deeper problem here in Spain, but also across Europe, are economies that are no longer structured to grow in sustainable ways and compete globally. Spain has shown already it can be an economic powerhouse in Europe. Now it needs to show it can face its economic challenges and adapt. Tom Gelton, NPR News.